Shalom Aleichem and Bruchem Avoyim. Today's topic will be pain management in halacha. Pain management is something we all do on a daily basis. Every one of us deals with this topic, and it seems so simple and straightforward that anyone does anything to alleviate pain. But many times we encounter dilemmas which need discussion to be able to find the right way to proceed. I've listed a few of the dilemmas which we'll discuss tonight, and I'll go over them one by one. Number one, if risky treatments to alleviate pain are permitted. Example, a C-section versus vaginal birth to spare labor pains. That means a woman that's terrified by the stories she's heard about labor pains, and she has the doctor to have a C-section, a cesarean, to spare these pains. The same question applies to induction of labor. If it's taking too long and she doesn't have the patience to wait and suffer, so she has to have the birth speeded up a bit, the question is if that's allowed or not. And then we have this epidural anesthesia. Many times this is a risky procedure. The question is if it's allowed, and if it's allowed on Shabbos. This involves Chilul Shabbos many times. If, especially if the physician is Jewish, is this procedure is Chilul Shabbos. The question is if it's allowed, if it's a procedure which is warranted just because to spare pain. And the third that belongs to this category is risky spinal surgery for chronic back pain. And then we'll discuss the second issue, is administering morphine to a terminal patient that might hasten his death, the so-called double effect. Many times, terminal patients are under they suffer terrible pain, and the only way to alleviate that pain is using morphine, and that can depress the respiration, and until recently, it was known to hasten death. Then we'll discuss use of the TENS device on Shabbos. That's an electrical device which helps alleviate pain. Since it involves electricity, there's a problem of Chilul Shabbos. And in general, palliative treatments and medication on Shabbos, how far are these medications allowed? Because many times we're dealing with Isser Shabbos, Isser medications, or maybe even Chilul Shabbos when it comes to taking these medications. Since these are complex issues, and we have the privilege to have here doctors which are experts in this field, I've asked Dr. Chaitin and Dr. Bohadana to a bit clarify to us some of these complex issues and to explain the contemporary medical approach. Dr. Chaitin.
Well, good evening. Thank you, Rabbi. I think what I'd really like to discuss tonight is the whole issue of pain. We know that the pain is definitely a physical phenomenon, and that just as we get a pain that can be stimulated to the peripheral receptors, will then go into the spinal cord, the spinothalamic tract, will then go into the brain and will get registered as the sensory areas, so too that impulse will go and will get registered in other areas of the brain. So pain is not just a physical phenomenon. Pain has an enormous emotional content, and in addition to that has a spiritual content and a psychosocial or a psychocultural content. And when we view pain and when we treat pain, we need to take all of this into consideration, because otherwise we're not accepting that pain is a total pain. And so that when we examine the patient for the type of pain, he's got the position of the pain, whether it radiates, what makes it worse, what makes it better, is there something that can stimulate it, is there something that can relieve it. We need to, in addition, find out how this patient is experiencing that pain. Is there an emotional attachment associated with that pain, and specifically in patients with terminal illnesses? What type of frightening experience does that pain elicit? Does it make the person frightened? What is he thinking about? Is he thinking about every time he gets the pain that this means he's going to die? That he's got a young child that he wishes he could see finish school? And what about the spiritual content of the pain? Do we take a correct spiritual history? Do we ask the patient what is important in his life? Because very, very often, a patient will say, I've got pain, when in fact it may be a spiritual or existential pain that he has. What is important in his life? Does he have a faith? Not does he have a religion, but does he have a faith? Does he believe that there's something greater than him? Is there a reason? Does he feel that he's been punished? Or is this pain meant to teach him some specific type of lesson? Does he have any type of support? Does he have community support? And how does he want us, as his healthcare professional, to address his specific pain that he's talking about? And what about the psychosocial issues of it? Does he understand, do we understand what pain means in his specific culture? Is he allowed to express that pain? So we're talking of a total body, a total symptom of pain, not just the physical pain that he's experiencing. I thought I'd just mention something about the basic pharmacology and some basic rules that we have when treating pain, is that it should be treated proactively. The minute the pain breaks through, the minute the patient experiences that pain, it's so much more difficult to actually get that pain under control. So we should be proactive in treating the pain. We know we use by the clock, so that we use a regular amount of anti-pain medication in order to control that pain. And we should use medications that are appropriate to treat the pain. We have many medications, whether they're opioids, adjuvant drugs, non-pharmacological treatments, which we're going to hear about a little bit later. And we should simplify the route of administration as much as possible. Rather give an oral medication than an intravenous medication. And what are the ethical guards which we as physicians should be adhering to in order to treat the pain? The goal of any medication is to improve the patient's quality of life. And as death draws near, medications may be required to allow for a more meaningful, more peaceful, more dignified death. But patients should never be undertreated, but never overtreated with medication. The goal should be the relief of symptoms wherever possible, but maintenance of his sensorium, to try and keep him as alert as possible for as long as possible. The ethical physician should be knowledgeable about approaches to symptom control, make regular assessments of those symptoms, must not hesitate to order medications with the intention of controlling the symptoms, but so too must not seek to hasten death by ordering medications in excess of what is required. We're going to speak about the double effect, and I'm sure other people will describe it. But it basically would imply that one administers a medication with the intention of controlling the patient's symptoms, knowing well that a side effect of that medication may cause death. But it's a matter of intent. We go back to what we said originally about controlling the pain. Before one thinks of over-medication, one must always look at that emotional, that spiritual, that psychosocial aspect. And even when you're thinking of, can I prescribe a medication, can I not prescribe a medication, we've got to remember that the medication may be in fact controlling the physical part, But what we can do as healthcare providers and as professionals is provide that emotional and that spiritual support. Okay. Just to remember that the most common reason for physician-assisted suicide, which does take place, unfortunately, in some parts of the world, is certainly not pain. It's depression. It's unrelieved psychological and psychosocial distress, loss of dignity, and loss of quality of life.
Good evening, and thank you very much for your way. I was asked specifically to talk a bit more about the issue of the double effect that was brought up, which is certainly an aspect of the care that I provide patients in palliative care that we see a lot. Although, I mean, we see a lot. We don't see a lot because, as you'll see, it's something that actually has become quite redundant. I mean, here I'm going to try to provide you with some of the facts that we know about what is the double effect as it applies to pain medications and terminal illness. I mean, certainly, as Dr. Chasen was saying, you know, pain is a multifaceted type of disorder. I mean, it's one of the things that, unfortunately, is most common in terms of its presentation. When patients present themselves to doctors, it's always about a complaint of pain. It's the first thing we teach our students, medical students and residents, to be able to assess, and unfortunately, it's probably the worst symptom that is the worst assessed symptoms, I should say, that we see across the board in residency and medical students, and certainly the worst treated because of multiple fears that doctors as well as patients have when it comes to pain medications in particular. And I think one of the most important aspects of these fears, as we know, is addiction, but probably another one is this issue of double effect that I'm going to talk about. Just as a historical background, I mean, the double effect itself is a principle, it's an ethical principle that seeks basically to try to understand or, you know, give reasons to justify certain actions that we know will provide not only a good effect, but also a bad effect. But that's what the double effect is about. And it's not just something that we apply to medicine per se. Okay, it's attributed to Thomas Aquinas, which is a philosopher and theologian from the 13th century, I think, who, especially in terms of, I guess, different issues that might have come up, especially in wars, where we know civilians might die after, in trying to eliminate the enemy, some deaths will occur at the same time. And so the intent wasn't to get rid of these civilians, but more the enemy themselves, and therefore there was always a loss of life, which is expected. But it's a matter of trying to weigh one against the other. And so the basic principle of double effect is this doctrine that states that a performance of an action having both a good and bad effect would be defensible or ethically permissible, if you will, if it satisfies four criteria. First of all, the action itself has to be morally good or at least neutral. And only the good effect is intended, even if the bad effect is foreseen. And the good effect is not achieved by way of the bad effect. And certainly the good results would outweigh the bad results. And as I said, this is going to be applied to multiple things other than medicine. But specifically in medicine, we know that it applies to pain medication, as well as in the earlier days of vaccinations, for example, is also one potential risk of vaccinating people and causing death from especially live virus, where on one hand, some may die from the vaccine itself, but the overall benefits was certainly would much outweigh the minor loss of life, if you will, from the vaccine itself. As it applies to pain, the basic facts are, I mean, after several years, many years, maybe 30, 35 years of palliative care medicine per se, it's well known that it's actually a redundant aspect. I mean, the issue is being able to treat pain for what it is and being able to slowly titrate as we understand better the pharmacology and the way the medications are administered, that in fact we very, very, very rarely see, almost never see, any respiratory depression, which is what really is what the fear side effect that would potentially then lead to this hastening of death. And in fact, in terminal illness, many times we do use these medications at very high doses, and patients are able to tolerate them very well, as long as we've gone through a certain process. And that's the whole ethical aspect here, is how do we administer those medications in order to avoid adverse side effects. And we know for a fact that even in euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide, in fact, morphine or any of its other opiates sort of relatives are not used, and then they don't work, really. The medications that are used, and you can check this, the Oregon puts out this this report every year on the physician-assisted suicide that they have in their state, and it's never, never used. It's mostly barbiturates that are used for this, for the means of trying to actually kill the other patients. So it's in fact a redundant aspect as far as medical, as far as pain control is concerned. And the unfortunate fact is that it remains a belief amongst a lot of health professionals themselves, and therefore there's a fear, and so pain is therefore undertreated. There's a fear of administration, and patients as well. There's sort of a widespread belief that this is something that still exists, and that these medications would potentially lead to health, to death. And therefore, if you think about it, it's actually not something that could be permissible ethically if so much fear is around it, that in fact there's this reticence in order to before trying to prescribe those medications, and unfortunately lead to increased suffering and poorer quality of life, especially as we near towards the end of life in most of our patients.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Chesney and Dr. Guardana. I'll try to follow up and take your explanations and try to find the basis in Aloha for the treatment and try the solutions for these dilemmas. First, an introduction. Pain, the feeling of pain is one of our most primitive sensations, and it's, of course, vital to maintaining health and well-being. Pain is also an integral part of childbirth. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Chava, to Eve, "Be'etzev tzar divonim," and Rashi says, "Zu tzar leida." It's part of life. Childbirth is goes together with pain. Tzar, pain, is also mentioned in the Gemara when it comes to awarding damages, compensation when someone damages someone else. Nezek tzar, ripoi sheves v'boshes. Tzar is a very tangible value. It's also part of Kiyum HaMitzvahs. For instance, by the mitzvah of circumcision, Bris Milah. There was an interesting debate that basically comes up in every generation. About 100 years ago, one of the gladiators, so-called the Sefer Imre Yosher, was asked if a ger, a grown, a 30-year-old girl has to undergo circumcision if we can use local anesthesia for the bris. And he explains, he brings down a medrash. The medrash says, "Ba'avrom Avinu, hirgish v'nitztar k'day shayachku l'akadosh baruch yizchurei." Avrom Avinu did everything. He should have tzar, he should have pain during the bris milah, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu doubled his heart for that. So he concludes from there that pain, tzar, of the bris milah is part of the bris. It's part of the covenant that HaKadosh Baruch Hu made with Klal Yisrael. And therefore, when it comes to children, 8-day-year-old children that undergo circumcision, we never heard that anesthesia should be used, although Chazal already knew about that certain types of local anesthetics, it was never suggested to be used. He does agree in a grown-up that anesthetic, local anesthetic can be used, but not in the case of young children. So we see from here, and also there's a letter of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Chaim Lubavitcher, and he brings down from the Das HaAchroinim that Tzar is Inyan Ikari, it's a central part of Mitzvah Smidah. So we see that Tzar is part of Mitzvahs too. When it comes to healing, there's no question that treatment of pain and relief of suffering is included in the mitzvah of verape yerape. But to what extent? And what is considered a legitimate treatment for pain and what not? Let's address the first question I brought up. A cesarean just to save the pain of childbirth. You know, many things are, when you ask someone, there's a knee-jerk reaction, it's unacceptable. The goal is to make a surgery just because she wants to spare herself the pain of childbirth. Everyone has it, and worse than nothing happens. Why should we do it? This question was discussed by many various ones. And there are many reasons why the postkin did not agree to have cesarean performed only because of convenience. And sparing of pain is also considered convenience. First, they quote Kabbalah. There's a lot of sources in Kabbalah that say that it's dangerous to change, to play around with the exact moment a person is destined to get born. So they'll say that a person is born in a certain model, a certain look, and if he's born too early or too late, it might have an adverse effect on his life. But then halakhically, the English Moshe, of Moshe Zevitzadik group and Moshe Feinstein, he discusses this question twice. He basically talks about induction of labor. In Yerodeh, Chelik Beis, Siman Ayin Dalet, and again in Chelik Dalet, he mentions a few reasons why this is unacceptable. First, he says, every childbirth is dangerous. But since this is the way of life, everyone has to go through it. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu probably, surely, built into the nature that it's natural and there's a certain type of protection of a woman that has to undergo childbirth. But if we start playing around with it, we make it earlier or later, make it faster, do surgery when it's unnecessary. This is an unnecessary danger. It's an unwarranted danger which should be avoided. And he even goes on to say that a birth which was done earlier and it comes out to be done on Shabbos is an unnecessary chilul Shabbos. Well, she didn't have to have this child on Shabbos. And many times, he says, doctors try to speed up the birth because of their convenience, not of the convenience of the patient. They want to go on vacation or they want to go home and it's taking too long or other reasons. So he disagrees unless there's a medical reason to have the zirus, as it's called, the induction. He does not agree to have it done. And all these arguments apply also to a cesarean. I'm sure the doctors are aware that the medical establishment is worried about the growth of the percentage of births which are cesarean, and there's a growing feeling that many of these surgeries are unnecessary. And I also read something interesting, that a research was done, and it shows that the stress the child undergoes during the childbirth is beneficial to the process of starting grieving. Certain types of chemicals are released during this trauma, which the child needs to start proper breathing. And during a C-section, this does not happen. So not only is it unwarranted to this unnecessary risk for the mother, it's also unbeneficial for the child. This is acceptable to me.
So therefore, you have this phenomenon called too posh to push, where people don't really want to be stretched and disfigured, and they would rather have a little bikini mark. So if a patient now comes to you and says, "This is what I want," is this awesome?
What do you do? What you as a doctor, what would you say?
Me? I'm a neurologist, assures us.
More people now asking for cesareans.
And you have a problem with that, to go an unnecessary cesarean?
I think, you know, you have to... I do have a problem, and I try to counsel them, and it's a lot of the counseling in your approach. There's some doctors that say, no problem, we'll book you at 9 o'clock on, you know, when you're 39 weeks, and you'll have a cesarean. Because it's easy, it's... The morbidity associated with it today is not high, although there's good evidence that shows that if you look at larger numbers, you have increased risk of complications, but the way we know it, come in at 9 o'clock, chances are at 9:30 you're holding your baby in the recovery room and everything went well.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot on how you counsel.
And that, but what about ethically?
Ethically, today. Today, it's more and more, I mean, if you look at our guidelines, they say that societies are not pushing this, but they accept it on a case-by-case basis, because there's a lot of literature that says that in the long run, if you have an elective cesarean, 20 years down the road, the bladder's not going to fall down, you're going to have less chances of having prolapse, so they can argue that they pay the fear that we discussed before, and people are very scared of saying, they say, well, listen, I have a 30% chance of having a cesarean anyways. Just walking into the labor and delivery room.
So the percent is now 30% of births. This is very high.
30%, yeah.
Extremely high.
So they say, I don't want to go through 12 hours of labor just so that I'll end up with a cesarean and have all the recovery of a labor and of an operation.
Okay, so we see that halakhically there is a problem.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you were asking that simple case on the front physician would be usher?
I wouldn't say awesome, but it's wrong to do it.
What halakhic principle do you violate when in this situation? I understand with my...
The physician or the patient?
What halakhic principle is violated?
According to the Moshe, the halakhic principle of undue risk. She will undergo a risk. This is more a philosophical approach that happens more she... protects the person who does it the natural way. But even not, we just heard from there are statistics saying there's a higher risk of morbidity.
No, some people are saying it's actually safer. In other words, the complications may be safer. Like long-term complications is safer, and the risk to the baby is not as...
It's worse for the baby. I mean, it's true, you know, what you were saying, if you have a vaginal delivery, the kid is having physio. You know, essentially that's what it is. It's clearing out their lungs and they're less likely to have
respiratory
distress when they come out. The other problem with an elective cesarean, and this is something that we see, is that sometimes we're off with our dating. And so we think that the baby's 39 weeks and will come out no problems, but in fact we're off by 2 weeks. And we deliver a baby by cesarean at 37 weeks. And we've seen that elective cesareans are more likely to have these respiratory problems than the neonate. But all that being said, a lot of doctors believe that the cesarean is a safer thing for the first time around. You come in for a first baby, someone says they want one baby.
That's it, but they want only one baby.
But the person who says, I want three kids, well then you're talking about the second time you have to do a cesarean, you can have a placenta previa and a creta. Can have a lot of more complications the second time around.
So isn't the incidence of birth trauma surely lower with the cesarean than with the vaginal?
Birth trauma to the baby, yeah. But the only thing is, when you talk about the serious morbidity of respiratory distress and stuff like that, if you're off a week with your dates, or even a cesarean, they say 39 weeks, you're kind of safe, but sometimes you're off with your dating.
But your 30% rate reflects the fact that it's safer for the baby to be delivered by cesarean than through vaginal birth. That's why the rate is so high.
You know, the rate is high because we have this way of monitoring the babies, which is very off. We use electronic fetal monitoring, which we look at this tracing, we're like, okay, I know these cells are bad, but we're not good at telling which kid is actually in distress. We have a low threshold, we say, well, I don't want to wait 12 hours, 8 hours, let me take it out now when I know the kid's good, because a cesarean today is very easy to do. You call the anesthetist, who probably has an epidural in place anyways, and so they just bring him to the OR, give a dose through the epidural and we do our operation. It's unfortunate, it's convenient a way to do it.
Again, this word comes up, convenient.
Yeah, and it's sad to say, but you don't want to sit there at the bedside when you look at medical legally, all the law, no one gets sued for doing a cesarean. People who are going to get sued is because they delayed a bad tracing.
Right, so that's the point.
Yeah, you don't have a problem. You didn't improve morbidity to the kid in any way.
But contemporary medicine tells you that when the tracing goes bad, the baby's at risk, and if you wait, then, and something bad does happen, you're going to be at risk, from a medical legal point of view. So, in fact, even from a medical point of view, if something happened to a baby, you'd have a hard time explaining why you didn't do that there.
Yeah, but when we actually look back at these cases, we're taking out maybe 20 kids for one kid that we
see. That heart rate variability monitoring varies.
For one.
Yeah, I would say.
As it relates to the halakha, the reason for not doing cesarean section is because there's increased risk. Here we're talking about the reason for doing cesarean section is that there may be decreased risk, but not to the mother, but to the baby.
I would weigh the specific case. Only when the doctor tells him, in this specific case, there's a reason for a higher risk with the vaginal delivery, then we would allow it.
And that's not a halakhic dilemma. If you have a question with your tracing, no one's going to tell you, you're in no place halakhically to do a cesarean section.
No, you're right.
The question becomes, someone comes in at 24 weeks and say, look, I want to plan my cesarean on May 15th, because I don't want to labor, and that's 3 months down the road.
But the Moshe Feinstein's time didn't have tracings.
Sure.
So it's either vaginal birth. These indications for cesarean section were very different than they are today. So
okay, I think we should go on to the next topic. The next topic will be epidural anesthesia during childbirth on Shabbos. There was an exchange of letters, a very interesting exchange of letters between two Gedolei Yisrael on this issue. The problem is when there's no apparent medical indication for the anesthesia other than a maternal wish to spare her from the pain during childbirth. So the question was, if this procedure can be done on Shabbos. Now, if the physician is non-Jewish, then the problem isn't that much of a problem, but because even for a Chodesh Aimless Schooner, anything can be done by a non-Jewish physician. But if it's a Jewish physician that has to do this procedure, which is Chilul Shabbos, maybe Chilul Shabbos D'oraisa, the question is if this is allowed or not.
Why would that be Chilul Shabbos? It's putting a needle into the spine.
Hello? No, not even that. You have to withdraw cerebral spinal fluid, don't you?
Not necessarily.
They have to know where the needle is.
But you put the needle in, and you take out the stylet, and if the CSF drips out, then you know you're in.
That's the spinal.
You're going to go
to the same part.
It's a
spinal. So after there's no fluid there?
No.
And there's no blood in there?
Well, you're making up from the skin. There might be. It depends.
No, but you don't have to withdraw blood like a
heavy line. No, there's no intention to withdraw blood.
Okay. Okay, so the only question would be if the doctor has to drive to the hospital to do this. And I've read a few reports from doctors on this issue. Some doctors argue that an epidural has a beneficial effect on the fetus too. Some, when it's a healthy fetus, it's not much of a difference, but if the fetus has some congenital disorders, and during labor, if there's no anesthesia administered, it decreases the uterine blood flow by 20%. So that might have an impact on the child.
But isn't
that's a good question. The question is, what does Jewish Moskuna mean that this treatment I'm giving her is to help treat her condition? Epidural has only to do with pain.
So let's say you had a terminal cancer patient, suddenly you began having excruciating pain on Shabbos, and they needed something to relieve the pain. A similar example. So there you would say that...
Very good. So this rule you're quoting now is the rule of the Magid Mishnah, Rav Magid. Rav Magid says that a person who is in a dangerous condition, a chodesh yesh b'skuna, who are allowed to be Mechal Shabbos to administer to his needs, even if they don't have a direct effect on his treatment. For instance, if he's suffering from some internal illness and he has an earache, we can treat that earache even through Chilul Shabbos because it has an overall effect on his well-being. By Yoredes, there's another rule which can be invoked, which is the rule of Yesuve Date. Chazal said that a woman that's going to childbirth, it's a very important her state of mind. We have to make sure that she's in a relaxed state of mind. There's a very interesting example given by Chazal. A parturient that is blind. We're allowed to light a candle to please her. She has no idea the candle is on or off.
But she
knows that people, the doctor is going to have the light on, and the doctor is going to be able to treat her in a better manner. That's why it's allowed to be turned on, although it doesn't have a direct impact on her treatment. So these two klulim are the basis of allowing epidural anesthesia on Shabbos.
Actually, we had a case in the hospital that I had to deal with about 2 months ago, where a complaint from a family that was non-resident of Quebec came into the liver and they wanted an epidural. And the anesthetist said, well, an epidural is an elective procedure, and they wanted the money up front in order to do the epidural. Anyways, in answering the complaint, I sent the complaint to the chief of the department, who said an epidural is only one form of it's an elective form of pain control, and it's not the only form, and there are other effective methods of pain control other than epidural. So
how much do they cost?
No, they don't cost
anything.
It's part of the
higher degrees of a lot of times they can charge greater.
The Mephlaikas, yes.
What you say is that the epidural is only to elevate pain, because the word only is just too much, because pain by itself is a reason to come. It's not all, it's only to elevate pain. It's pain by itself should be enough to...
That's a question, yes, a good question you brought up. But treating pain in itself, the question is if we are allowed to be in the Chalal Shabbat to treat pain. That's a question by itself, because as we said before, childbirth involves pain. If we want to alleviate the pain of childbirth, if it has no effect on the health of the mother and the child, why should we allow a Chalal Shabbat? That's a question. We'll get to it later on. We'll talk about it in general. If pain is considered an illness which justifies Chilul Shabbat. The difference of opinion between two Gedalim, the Ger Rebbe Ulrich Shulam and the Bnei Menachem and Rav Osner, was at what stage of the childbirth should this epidural be administered. The Rav Osner quoted the Rambam. The Rambam says, a very interesting passage in the Rambam. The Rambam says that the klal yisuv data only applies to a yoledes that is screaming from pain. According to Rav Osner, the time to administer epidural is only when the pain has already started. But if you want it administered beforehand, before she's experiencing any pain, according to Rav Osner, it's not justified. But the Gedolei Rebbe disagrees, and he says, we also see that this klal yisuv data is applied to allow traveling together with the yoledes to the hospital, even though the pain has not begun at all, because we have to be sure that she is in a relaxed state of mind. So, according to the Ger Rebbe, there's no such limitation when this can be administered. So the conclusion of these two gedolim is that epidural can be administered on Shabbos, not only when there is a risk to the fetus and this is given to benefit the fetus, but also when the reason is because of Yisuv Hadat, to get her in a relaxed state of mind, epidural is allowed. If we can wait with it, it's better, according to Rav Ozna. But if not, it can be given at an earlier stage too.
So how would Rav Ozna answer the Gerer Rebbe? Because that's a bomb. You can travel with your lettuce where there's no pain at all. So why can't you administer an epidural?
Okay, so I think that Rav Ozna would argue, saying that traveling with a yoledes, you can't put it off until later, because it's dangerous to wait too long. But if you can wait until later, then wait. If anything can be done later, it shouldn't be done earlier.
What does it mean to say if you can wait? Is it the doctor's having too much pain? Right? Or is that exactly what it means if you can wait?
No, sometimes when the labor is in an advanced stage, maybe it's too late to administer the epidural. I think.
It's also early.
Hmm?
Sometimes it's too early, you're not sure, are they really in real labor, or this is real labor that can take 3 days?
Sometimes is there also sometimes too late to administer an epidural?
Yeah, if the head's about to come out, you're not going to put her, you know, take 20 minutes to do an epidural, and then, you know, but too early is a problem,
mm-hmm.
because you can put in the epidural, and then the contractions stop, and then you're faced with a catheter in the epidural space. And you have to start either stimulating labor or inducing her. And that's not something that you want to do.
Yes.
Maybe we should ask the Rebbe Sender when it's too late. Because the Rebbe doesn't know when it's too late. The Rebbe Sender is going to tell you when you proceed if you need it.
Okay. Okay, let's go over to the second issue, which is morphine to a terminal patient. The question is twofold. One, palliative treatment, which involves a risk. And then, what is it then when we know that hastens death? For example, we heard from Dr. Boadana that this is almost a non-issue anymore. But let's take a look at the issue as it was discussed by the Gdol Yisroel. The first source that deals with undergoing risk to treat pain is the Sefer Moir Ektzil of the Gaon Kedenden, who lived about 250 years ago. He talks about a person who was suffering from kidney stones. And he writes as follows, yes, shebochrim besufik nefushes, there are people that elect to undergo a dangerous surgery, kedai leinuzay miyesurim kushim, to be saved from the excruciating pain. Those people who give themselves into surgery, a stone in the bladder, sand in the kidneys, pain that's like death. For these people, we let them do whatever they wish. We don't interfere. Because many times they can be helped. So he's talking about a situation where it's a suffix nefushes, and surgery 250 years ago was dangerous, and probably there was no anesthesia either, no sterilization. And nevertheless, the Poitse Kador, Rav Yankovan, agreed that such pain is unbearable, and it's justified doing anything, even risky treatments, to save us from this pain. So this is the answer for undergoing a risky procedure. Now let's go over to the question of undergoing a procedure that has a so-called double effect. There's a landmark decision written by Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach of the Tzaddik Lebruta 30 years ago. He was asked by Professor Shimon Glick from Beersheba this question about terminal patients that need this medication. He quoted the Chazal that say, "Ilemulei Abdua Lechananiya Meshul Va'azavia Polso Letzalme." Chananiya Meshul Va'azavia, the Posuk says that they let themselves be thrown into a pit of lions and not to kneel before the idol. And the Chazal say, if they would have been tortured, they wouldn't have been able to take the torture, and they would have done what they were ready to give away their life, not to do, but torture, they wouldn't be able to take the torture. So, according to that, says the Shlomo Zalman, torture and pain can be worse than death. So this Ismail mitzvah to treat and heal, to preserve life, there's no question that there's a mitzvah to treat and heal and save from suffering. And he goes on and he mentions the idea of what we heard before in general medical ethics of intent. As long as the intent and the intention of the doctor and the patient is to treat the pain, even if when there is a side effect which is not wanted, nevertheless, this procedure is considered a procedure of healing, and we don't take into account the unwanted side effect. And then he goes on, and he uses another argument, which says that the huit neshaimer b'suim Hashem, many things that are dangerous, but since people do it on a daily basis, and they're not careful enough, that turns it into something which is an accepted risk. People do it, people smoke, people eat junk foods, people do other things which are not healthy. So these things are not considered as undertaking an undue risk. So he uses the same argument when it comes to treating a patient for pain, since the side effects are something which everyone treats and people aren't careful about, so it's not considered as a euthanasia, and therefore he allowed administering morphine to terminal patients. There's a tshuva in Sitzeliezer, who just passed away, also one of the biggest poskim in the fields of medical ethics. He adds an interesting argument. He brings up in the Ramban, why did the Torah have to say, V'rapa y'rapa mikan shenitan reshus l'roifa l'rapa? A roifa, a doctor, has permission to heal. Why do you need permission? Why does the Torah have to give permission? If you tell me it's a mitzvah, I understand. It's an obligation to heal. But I'm allowed to heal. Why shouldn't they be allowed to heal? What's the problem with healing? So the Ramban says, Sha'ayluchu v'refuais. There isn't a medication. Eiluskuna. Every medication is dangerous. Masha marapa lezei, maimis lezei. A medication which is good and heals one affliction is dangerous for something else. And we know that. You just have to open any medication and take a look at the small words in the insert, and you see the contraindications, not good for this, not good for that, it has side effects, it's not good with other medications. Very often medications, you know, I want to ask a dermatologist about the medication for fungus, nail fungus. And he laughs and tells me, I also have nail fungus and I don't take these medications. They're dangerous. But they were developed and people take them. So, and I'm sure that most medications are that way. So, according to this Ramban, we have to say that we have to take a look at the reason why this person is taking the medication. If the benefit by taking the medication outweighs the side effects, then it's justified. And if it's justified, the same applies to a terminal patient, and we have to treat his pain. Even if they have to use narcotics or opiates, nevertheless, it's justified because, and he adds, the titulator adds, an interesting point. Yesurim, a terminal patient who is under terrible pain, they are mekarev es misusay. The pain is hastening his death. A person who's under pain doesn't have an appetite, he can't eat, his blood pressure can go sky high. But if we treat the pain in the right manner, in a controlled manner, this person feels better, he gets appetite, he can eat, and he has a will to live. That's such an important factor. A person who gives up, you can't even save him with the best treatment. But if he has chayshik, he has will to live, and he has an upbeat outlook, an optimistic outlook, then we're giving him life. And that's his conclusion of the Sitzeliezer too. There's no question about it that if it's a medication and the intention of the doctor and the medical staff is to help the patient and to treat them and to have them improve the quality of life, it's a mitzvah. One condition is brought down from Rabbi Yosef Shlita. He says that care should be taken that the single injection that is given should not be the single injection that's going to cause the death. If it's gradual, even if it gradually has an adverse effect on his breathing or on his life expectancy, then it's allowed. It shouldn't be done with one single act. And also, the primary put a few conditions on the treatment. One, the intention has to be done to treat the patient and not for euthanasia. Secondly, the physician has to be familiar with these treatments, to be careful and to give the correct dosage. The condition of the patient has to be good enough that the treatment, the medication, will not cause an immediate death. Okay, so let's go ahead and talk about the 10th device of Shabbos. Maybe...
I just have a comment.
Yes.
The comment is that we heard that these medications are not... There's just a coroner's report that I received about 6 months ago of a French-Canadian man who went to a hospital with renal colic, kidney pain, and he had kidney stones, and he was given a narcotic, and he died. And he died because of respiratory depression. And the coroner has now come out with recommendations to all hospitals, which we're all in the process of applying. And any patient now who's going to get a narcotic has to be monitored. And so...
there's launchers in the hallway.
No, yeah, they have to be monitored. In fact, it's a real, we're in the process of...
How can you reverse such a condition?
There are drugs that you can reverse it. Mm-hmm. In order to detect respiratory depression, there's a drug that you can give. And in fact, if you have to use the drug, it's considered a marker that you're not using the narcotics properly, that you're using it too heavily, if you have to actually go and use it in patients. It's a marker of bad medical care.
But does it affect the analgesic properties of the opiates to give this to you?
It reverses it.
So if the breathing is stimulated, then he's starting to experience pain again.
Yes.
this was truly within intravenous. It's not an oral.
Right.
It's the same thing with
Narcan.
No, but I'm talking about this monitoring. It's for intravenous?
No, for
it was used as morphine and poor knowledge of how to use dilaudid, and that person died because there was an overdose of dilaudid, and a person was opioid naive with acute pain.
Right.
And you know, and so the whole coroner's report was overly exaggerated, and I've read it myself. But yes, the recommendations have to be made because certainly something, and this was a very prominent person also, it's an actor or somebody, known in the Quebec community,
so... But the point in the coroner's report is that he reviewed that there were many other deaths in Quebec.
Yeah, because the
dosage
wasn't correct.
Okay, so maybe that's where the rabbi said before, in other words, be careful not to use that one dose to kill the patient, so watch...
You have to be careful. And certainly you could cause respiratory depression and you can kill patients with those medications, and you have to be very careful with the dose that you administer. And so many times do I come across on the wards in our only on our hospital where they make mistakes between dilaudid and morphine, where dilaudid is given, just as if it was morphine or another weak opioid, and really it's, five times more potent, and certainly patients have been either confused or other side effects that would not expect it.
Let's conclude. The 10th device basically is very simple. It's not different than any other, like a hearing aid. If it's turned on before Shabbos and the electrodes are connected, then there shouldn't be a problem. Going out on the street where there's no air with this device is a problem. It's like a halter, which is considered hoitsua. But working here in Montreal, we have air in most of the neighborhood, so that shouldn't be an issue. I just want to conclude with talking a few words about treating pain on Shabbos. Now, look, it says that acute pain, internal acute pain, is considered a dangerous condition allowing for the shots. For instance, if a person all of a sudden feels a very strong, intense pain internally, you have to call the hospital, you have to go to the hospital, no question about it. But the reason is, not because the pain itself is considered a dangerous illness, because the pain itself is a symptom of something happening which might be dangerous. And even if we don't know if the person has anything, it can be a sign of appendicitis or something else, which is an acute, dangerous condition, and they have to be treated immediately, and it allows clinical shots. I can go on and on and describing all types of conditions which might be indicated by this pain. But what happens when the diagnosis is known, as we heard before, for a kidney stone? A person is known to have a kidney stone and is suffering pain. Now, maybe I'm mistaken, but I don't think it's dangerous if a person knows exactly where the kidney stone is. He doesn't have a blockage of the urine flow, but he's in excruciating pain. Is this a reason to be mechal shel
tumah? I don't know. When that renal colic sets on, even though we know this person has renal colic, that stone might move and block the ureter.
But if you see that, there's still a urine flow.
No, it comes from the other kidney. That's just comes from the other kidney. The thing is that the pain of renal colic pain is described by people who've had both childbirth and renal colic. Renal colic is supposed to be more severe pain than childbirth.
Okay, but again, severe pain in itself is not dangerous. Well, dangerous is because of the reason.
I'm not sure you can say so easily that severe pain is not dangerous.
Let's hear why.
Well, I mean, it's an acute stress event, and someone can have an underlying condition that's not recognized. It could trigger myocardial infarction. It could trigger all sorts of physical consequences.
Person with gout. Person who has gout. It's very painful from the tips of his toes.
Right.
Is that a dangerous condition?
Severe pain. The localization of the pain and the nature of the condition per se is not dangerous, but it's an issue perhaps of what the statistical risk is and how realistic a complication could be. But certainly severe pain is an extreme stressor and stress.
So if someone has a gout attack on Shabbos, is he allowed to drive to the hospital? I don't know.
I think the issue is what you can do to relieve the pain. And I think you're suggesting that you can't do something that would otherwise be mechal of Shabbos to relieve the pain. And I'm just wondering whether, since the pain itself may pose some danger, maybe someone who's having extremely severe pain, that could be considered in itself.
But a person who's known to be healthy, he only has this condition. He doesn't have any heart condition.
But you don't know that. The thing is, let's say, when somebody gets a heart attack, they're perfect until they get that heart attack. Right?
Look at that risk factor.
Everything
about a young person.
No, but even a young person, I just saw a patient back in the emergency room who was 45 years old and just had bypass.
Thinking people in their 20s present coronary disease.
I agree. So what the doctor's saying is that if such a person who's predisposed to getting a heart attack, that heart attack could be precipitated by that same event.
But this can be precipitated by many stressful events.
Exactly. But
not only for pain.
Right, but it's preventable.
It's something that we treat, though. To me, I have a tough time saying, well, you cut yourself, you need 10 stitches, that's valid to go to the hospital, but you've got this horrendous pain that you can't even see straight. But we know that it's your gout, so that's okay, we can't.
But we have rules in halakha. The rules say that tzilul shabbat is only allowed when there's a danger to the person, to the life of the person. Yes?
Just in terms of tzilul shabbat, let's say, isn't a chodesh enbo sakana also somebody who's in a situation where he, for example, can't, he has severe migraine?
Absolutely. This person is chodesh enbo sakana. Chodesh enbo sakana means the person who cannot function as a healthy person. There's a severe headache, it's chodesh enbo sakana. Even though he can go around and go to the office, but he's a chodesh enbo sakana. But chodesh enbo sakana cannot be in the house of only to a non-Jew. A Jewish person cannot be mechal shabbos. You don't have to make call the phone or
drive. Take medication.
He can take medication.
He can be a for
a. But they were right. But not a toilet.
So
it's
So if you're going to treat, so if you're going to treat pain with medications, you're allowed to take.
No problem. But the question is he allowed to call a doctor? Is he allowed to drive to the hospital? That's the question.
Ah, okay. I thought the question was, he allowed to treat his pain?
No, the treating pain is a function of his calling. No question about it.
Okay.
Absolutely.
He has to.
The question is.
When the pharmacy buys,
he knows that this is gout.
Yeah, absolutely. We're talking about a person who has arthritis.
Right.
He has an attack with arthritis. It's not a dangerous condition, but it's a very painful condition. Can he? Okay, over there, medication is enough. But if he has to do a chemo shot with the support, he doesn't have the medication, he has to drive to the pharmacy or whatever.
But if he's in doubt, he doesn't know exactly, maybe it's something else.
So, if there's a doubt, if it's a dangerous condition, no questions asked. Yes.
So if I understand what you're saying correctly, let's take a person with a kidney stone,
mm-hmm.
which is extremely painful, but as far as we know, assuming there is enough knowledge that there's no sequela from the pain itself, so your advice to him would be that he could do everything that he needs to in order to get to a physician and get the pain relief, but he shouldn't do a lot when he's arrived.
Yes, so the point I just mentioned, that kidney stones can be dangerous because of the
blockage. But assuming that the situation is gout, then,
mm-hmm.
an extremely excruciating attack of gout, the person knows he has gout, cannot argue strongly that there is a high significant statistical risk to the person. So there he would say, if he makes a phone call to Shinui, if he gets a taxi and
the
Gentile or something mm-hmm. like that, he can undergo a whole chain of events in order to get to the hospital, to get the right treatment and so on,
yes.
as long as he's not over a malachim.
Yes, correct. Any questions? Yes.
In terms of the issue of refua on Shabbat in general,
mm-hmm.
but who is not allowed to take what medication on Shabbat?
Okay, I think that will be a share for by itself, but in a few words, anyone who is a chodesh ayin beskona, means a person who cannot function because of the pain or because of his general feeling, he is allowed to take medication.
What means he can't function?
He can't function as a healthy person. He can't
work. Can't function.
Again, it's a drabonin is allowed. Medication is allowed, not chilul Shabbat.
Now, do you have to wait, like when I get my migraine?
Yeah.
So when it starts, that's when I have to take medication.
But you can take it, because it's a condition which will...
It will be, I know.
Okay, so you can proactively treat that. But if it's only a migraine means a slight discomfort, a toothache or something, which a person can function normally, he can go to work, he can do anything, as if it wasn't there, it's like heartburn, and acids. These things are not considered chodesh ayin beskona because he's not mutar lemishkat. He can function, and that's where the issur of medication comes into play. Okay? Thank you.
Is it possible to have a minion?
Yes.
Everything's possible.
Anybody wants to purchase these two cities in the last two shurim, they're available over there. And if you have to make some more, we'll make them make
it. Okay.